30-year-old woman. There's no word yet on a possible motive for the shooting. For NPR News, I'm Jillian Ferris-Cole in Flagstaff.
Suspected U.S. missile strikes in Pakistan leave at least a dozen alleged militants dead today. Officials say the attacks in the tribal region of North Waziristan are part of a more intense U.S. campaign to make it impossible for Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters to find refuge outside of Afghanistan in neighboring Pakistan. This year's number of suspected U.S. attacks in the region is more than double that of last year. Oil prices are at a two-year high, with demand increasing, especially in Asia, and producing countries showing no willingness to increase production. I'm Paul Brown in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
As you make your year-end giving decisions, please consider a gift to WILL. Listener support is the heart and soul of this station, and your gift will help pay for the programs you rely on next year. You can make a contribution online now at willpledge.org or mail a check to Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thank you.
This fall, the comic strip Doonesbury turned 40. It first appeared on October 26th, 1970. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the history of the strip, talk some about the man who created it, Gary Trudeau. And our guest is comic historian Brian Walker. He is the author of a newly published book, which is titled Doonesbury and the Art of G.B. Trudeau. It's just recently out from the Yale University Press. So if you're a fan of the strip and you're particularly interested in the artistic side, how it is that the strip is created and developed, you might want to take a look at the book. It was something that, as we will explain, was started. Gary Trudeau started drawing it when he was a student at Yale, but it wasn't very long before it attracted the attention of a cartoon distributor who obviously saw potential in its mix of humor and social commentary. And today, the strip is syndicated to a daily readership of nearly 100 million people. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Brian Walker. He organized the first major exhibition of Gary Trudeau's work, the Doonesbury Retrospective, at the Museum of Cartoon Art in 1983. He's also served as curator for more than 70 cartoon exhibitions. He's written many books on comics, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Walker, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
I'm fine.
And maybe I also want to mention here at the beginning your connection, among your connections to the business of cartooning, the fact that your dad, Mort Walker, is the guy who created Beetle Bailey and High and Lois.
That's true.
And that you're
still very much alive and working. He still draws Beetle Bailey, and I work with him on both strips as part of the staff.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, certainly he, in the history of cartooning, he also was one of those people who stands out as being an unusual case for one individual who has been responsible for a particular strip for that length of time.
Yeah, it's actually the record for the longest run on a creator's original strip, 60 years. He just celebrated his 60th anniversary, and he's been drawing it ever since the beginning, so... Mm. Quite a record.
For people who are interested in going back and reading past Doonesbury strips, there are plenty of collections of the strip, and that's really not, I think, your intent with this book, but it's more about how it is the strip is created.
Right.
So if you ask a question like that, if you look at a drawing, a Gary Trudeau drawing, is there something about it that's so distinctive that right away when you see it, you know that it's his?
Well, he certainly has a very, as most cartoonists do, a signature style, the way he draws, you know. All of his characters have this kind of half-lidded eye, and a number of them have this this sort of long sort of pencil noses, and you know, they're very recognizable, the characters. Mm-hmm. Although what I detailed in my book, which deals mainly with his artistic and creative evolution, is the strip has changed very much over the course of 50 years, the way it looks.
Mm-hmm.
When he started drawing Doonesbury, actually it started as a comic strip called Bull Tales, B-U-L-L Tales, at Yale University in 1968. And there was a new syndicate that was just starting up, which eventually became Universal Press Syndicate. And they were just looking for young talent to get them, you know, off the ground, and they discovered his cartoon in the Yale Daily News. And so he was hired really, you know, right out of college, and really didn't have that much professional experience. He drew in a style that was very influenced by the work of Jules Pfeiffer.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very minimal and kind of scratchy and really didn't even look that professional when he first started. And over the years, you know, he got, Gary got his master's in graphic design from Yale University, so he's definitely a talented artist and a graphic designer, and has designed lots of book covers and posters and all kinds of products and things. Started that, you know, redesigning the strip to use his full capabilities on it.
Yeah. When you look back at the early strips that he did, the Bull Tales, they were very much about college life. A lot of them had to do with the fates of the football team, and they were kind of rough. So you have to wonder what it was that these guys who saw the strip and approached him about syndicating it, what it was that they saw in it.
That's a good question, actually, because most of the early Bull Tales strips are about the very specific to Yale, about Brian Dowling, who was the quarterback then, who gave his name to the character BD. It was about college mixers and beer drinking and dating and, you know, your typical kind of college strip. And what it was that John McNeil and Jim Andrews, who were the original founders of the syndicate, saw in that strip, I think it had a certain topicality, a certain pacing. It was smart and witty, and you know, you can go back and read some of those Bull Tales strips and sort of chuckle at it, but they obviously saw something there, because certainly Gary has developed into one of the really the top cartoonist in the business over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly on a number of levels, the quality of the artwork now, I think, really makes the strip stand out. The things that he has done with the strip, the kind of stories that he has decided to tell, the fact that he has a very large cast of characters that he has now followed through long chapters of their lives, all of those things make the strip different. It seems that it was the case with him, though, that right from the very beginning, he really was intent on saying something, and that it was his intent right from the very beginning that this be different from the other kind of joke-a-day strips that were running in newspapers at that time and had run to that time.
Yeah, I found an interview that he did with a trade magazine called Editor and Publisher. It was just a few months after the strip debuted, and certainly the syndicate went out and sold the strip on the basis of, you know, this is, you know, not your father's comic strip. You know, this is, it's done by a young college student, really the first from the baby boom generation to do a nationally syndicated comic strip. And so they're talking to this reporter for Editor and Publisher, and John McNeil referred to the gags in Doonesbury. Gags being, you know, like it's a term kind of comic strip artists use for jokes or, you know, the kind of one-line, punchline style. And Trudeau responded, corrected McNeil and said, they're not gags, they're perceptions of the human condition. And the reporter said, he's got it all worked out, this one, and a lot of people are going to enjoy Gary do it his way. And, you know, that was from an interview in January 1971, only a few months after the strip started. Mm-hmm. So I think he... I mean, he would say he just didn't even know better, you know. He didn't know what the rules were, so he didn't follow them and ended up breaking a lot of rules. He told another story about meeting a lot of the professional cartoonists at a dinner, and he was or some kind of a meeting, a reception, and was proudly showing off his list of papers. Because Doonesbury launched with some pretty major papers, the Boston Globe, the Chicago Tribune, Washington Post. And he came away with it and said, you know, everybody was friendly and polite, but they were a little like, they didn't know what to make of this guy, you know. He was this kid from Yale University who's doing this, you know, strip that had political comment in it, and even things like pot smoking and, you know, that he approached and war protests and things like that right from the beginning. It just didn't seem like it fit into their idea of what a professional cartoonist should be doing.
Yeah, and certainly it's true. You look at the history of cartooning, there have been cases where one person has started a cartoon strip and then others have carried it on, and you might not have noticed, or, you know, maybe in some cases the strip actually improved. With a strip like Doonesbury, it's so much a personal expression of Gary Trudeau that it seems that one just can't imagine that if the day ever comes when he decides not to do it anymore or he can't, no one's going to come and take that strip over.
No, I think. I also think that it was the beginning of a trend in comics towards more personal and more autobiographical type of strips, you know, followed by strips like Kathy and For Better or For Worse, and by Lynn Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, people would often say something like, well, did you see what Trudeau did today, you know, which is not something you would often say about your typical kind of gag-a-day strip, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about Peanuts or Beetle Bailey or something, and the characters are really much more up out front. Whereas with Gary, you were always aware of where the writing was coming from, a certain point of view, a certain kind of, you know, as he calls it, dispatches from the front. You know, the illusion was that he was right there on the front lines in the Cultural Revolution, just scribbling this stuff off as it happened. You know, and that was how they marketed the strip in the beginning.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Brian Walker. He's written a lot about the history of comics and comes from a cartooning family himself. His dad, Mort Walker, the creator of Beetle Bailey and High and Lois, and that continues to be something of a family business for the Walkers. Brian Walker is the author of a new book. It's just recently out. It's titled Doonesbury and the Art of G.B. Trudeau. It's published by the Yale University Press. We have a caller here, and we will get right to them, someone who's on a cell phone calling from St. Anne, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Enjoying the program. Sure. Very much. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I had two quick questions for your guest. I was just wondering how much the Vietnam War figured into Gary Trudeau's work, if your guest thought it played an important part. And my second question is really a kind of a macro question. If you had a college kid, I'm in my 50s, but if there was a college kid today, talented cartoonist, given the demise of print journalism, newspapers in general, everything today is kind of focused on the Internet. I'm just wondering, where would your guests think somebody today could get their start as a cartoonist? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right.
Well, your first question about Vietnam is certainly... the star of the strip, BD, actually enlisted in the military during the Vietnam War in the early years of the strip. I think it was to get out of a term paper or something. and eventually met a Vietnamese terrorist named Fred, P-H-R-E-D, and kind of got lost in the jungles of Vietnam. And, of course, Gary Trudeau, you know, didn't have any direct experience in the military or in Vietnam, so it was kind of a certain kind of fantasy element to it, you know. It was this, I think he said, his message was, why can't we just all get along, you know. It was a little maybe naive optimism at the time, but not very realistic in terms of the actual war itself. Since then, he's covered more recently the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's actually visited, you know, in fact, I think, I don't know if he's back yet, but he was just in Afghanistan this past week. And the military has actually taken him to a lot of the VA hospitals, and he's talked to wounded warriors. And so he can be a little bit more accurate about the storylines that he does right now. The second question about aspiring cartoonists, I mean, I think that there are still careers that can be made in newspapers and newspaper syndication. I often try to put a positive spin by just saying it's not a real growth industry right now. And I think it's tough to break in. I think newspapers are cutting back or not really buying a lot of new strips. So it's a tough business to break into at this point. On the other hand, I think that it's kind of an open book what might happen on the internet with comic strips. It's very easy to post your work up on a website. There are other websites. There's one called Go Comics that has a thing called Comic Sherpa where you can debut your work online and people can see it. You know, of course, you're competing with, you know, tens of thousands, if not more, other aspiring cartoonists that are posting their stuff up on the web. But I know of instances of some cartoonists that did a blog or something online and got noticed by a publisher, and then a book contract resulted from that. I know a specific cartoonist named Brian Fies who did a thing called Mom's Cancer, which was a internet blog of a comic strip, and it got a book contract out of it with Abrams. So, you know, that kind of stuff can happen still.
I think it's interesting that just, in fact, I think just this past weekend on the NPR program On the Media, Gary Trudeau was interviewed, and he said something to the effect that he thought it was his intent. First of all, he said that he really wanted to keep doing the strip for as long as possible, but that he said something like he was concerned that maybe he might actually outlive the newspapers.
Yeah, I don't know if I totally agree with that. I mean, I think some of the big newspapers, particularly ones that were bought out by public corporations and stuff, have really taken a big hit in terms of having to fire their editorial cartoonists and columnists and things like that. But I still think there are sort of medium-sized suburban papers that are still publishing the comics. I know with our strips, Beetle Bailey and High and Lois, you know, we've lost a few papers, basically ones that went out of business, but it hasn't been, as Gary described it, going off a cliff or anything. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's, I think that there will always be newspapers, and hopefully there will always be comic strips in those newspapers. I think there's one cartoonist I know said, the days of the millionaire cartoonist might be over, you know. It may be a more modest, income career earning possibility.
Yeah. One way that I think that a lot of cartoonists have actually managed to make some money is by licensing their characters for various kinds of commercial products.
Right.
And one way that Gary Trudeau stands apart from a lot of other artists, I mean, there are others who made the same choice, but is that he has never done that. He's never licensed characters for other than for purposes of collections of cartoons. At least he's not done this for personal gain for himself, but what he has done is that he has done a lot of work, or he has allowed his work to be used by a variety of nonprofit organizations to raise money for whatever cause it is that they're dedicated to.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that I go into in quite depth in my book is all of the fundraising products that he has done, beginning probably in about the late 1980s. I think he did a couple I forget the original charity that he did it for, but he did, I think it was a T-shirt or something, and it raised a lot of money, and he said, God, I should have started doing this a long time before this, you know. So he did a number of, particularly in the 1990s, things for, there was one very ambitious campaign that he did with Starbucks that raised money for literacy programs across the country, raised over $1 million. And they did everything from Doonesbury, like authentic Hawaiian shirts with custom design patterns, figurines, posters, mugs, ties, you know. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is, of course, Gary and his, he works very closely with a designer named George Corsillo, who actually designed my book, designing these products and manufacturing, a lot of people have never seen them before. You know, I mean, they were available in Starbucks stores for a short time period. And so I think that's something people might be interested in looking at in my book.
And that's, you know, I think, and I'm sure that some of the credit here does indeed go to George Corsillo, but I think that I certainly enjoyed seeing those things, and I think that it shows you also Trudeau's artistic capability when you see what has been done with those characters once they let them out of that little box.
Right. Well, David Stanford, who's another collaborator with Gary, who was originally his book editor and works on all these projects, mainly as a writer, calls it the Doonesbury Universe, and it's constantly expanding. In fact, they just put up the new Doonesbury.com website, which is hosted by Slate. And it's just beautiful, state-of-the-art stuff. And but Gary is intimately involved in every aspect of the Doonesbury universe. I mean, everything goes through him. It oftentimes conceptualized by him, sketched by him, approved by him. He has picked a small group of very talented collaborators that he's just really in sync with, you know. So people like David Stanford, Don Carlton, who does the inking on the strip, George Corsillo, they're really like his, you know, right and left arms, if you will, you know, in doing stuff. And for one of my favorite pieces in the book is a poster that he designed in kind of a Toulouse-Lautrec style, mm-hmm. for a fundraiser at his kid's school in New York City. Now, of course, anybody outside of that event will have never seen this poster before. And it's just, it's a beautiful piece.
Yeah, that kind of thing is really nice. I also like the stamps, the Doonesbury stamps, which were, and it was at one point these things were designed, it was just a wonderful piece of design, and they actually were made into stamps with gummed backs and perforations, and I guess the story is that some people, when they got these things, actually put them on letters.
Well, there was actually, preceding that, he did a Sunday page with Zonker, and I think it was in kind of, they were called protest stamps, because I think the Postal Service had just raised the first-class rate or something. Mm. So he said, cut these out and stick them on your envelope. So people did that. With the stamp album, I think they tried to discourage that a little bit. You know, these aren't really for... you can't mail letters with these. When that first came out, it was published by Viking Penguin, so it was sold in bookstores and stuff. But, you know, like all of the licensed products that Gary has done, they were all non-profit fundraising efforts. Mm. I saved the whole thing. I never, you know, pulled the stamps out and stuck them on an envelope. It was too much of a collectibles item.
Well, it was too. It looks so beautiful. I would have had the same feeling. I'm sure I wouldn't have had the heart to tear it apart.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't really checked to see if those things are available on eBay, but I'd imagine that they could fetch some decent money.
Well, all of the various things that you have talked about, for example, these things that were created for Starbucks, the shirts and ties and coffee mugs and collectibles, I would think that there would be some people who'd be willing to pay some fairly serious money to be able to have something like that.
He did an actual mail order catalog called the Great Doonesbury Sellout in the early 90s. And that was all for, basically, I think there were four charities that benefited. Mm-hmm. And it was a company in California that made all this stuff. And the whole catalog itself, which Gary wrote a lot of the copy for, was kind of a satire of mail-order catalogs, you know? So it had a whole kind of humorous element to it where they just made these outrageous claims about these products and stuff like that, you know, and it was very tongue-in-cheek.
The guest in this hour of Focus, by the way, is Brian Walker. He's a cartoon historian, has written a lot about the history of cartooning and comics. He organized the first major exhibition of Gary Trudeau's work, the Doonesbury Retrospective, that was at the Museum of Cartoon Art in 1983. He has a new book out that's titled Doonesbury and the Art of G.B. Trudeau. It's published by the Yale University Press as a way of marking the 40th anniversary of the strip. Doonesbury first appeared October 26, 1970, and is still going very strong. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Doing a daily strip is a lot of work, and first you have to have the idea and decide what you want to do, and then you have to make it. And just even that, crafting the strip is a lot of work, and in cartooning for maybe as long as there's been cartooning, there is a way of splitting the work up. Different people may contribute to it, and this is something that you actually show in the book by showing pencil sketches, which is the first thing. That's what Gary Trudeau does. He draws it in pencil, and then another artist, and you mentioned him, Don Carlton, is the guy who then goes over it in ink to get us to the finished strip.
Right.
Maybe you could talk some more about exactly how that process works.
One of the things, you know, there are different kinds of cartoonists. There are magazine cartoonists and comic book artists and animators and, you know, editorial cartoonists. We're talking specifically about syndicated comic strip artists. The thing about syndicated comic strip artists is they have to have a strip in the newspaper every single day, 365 days a year, you know, 7 days a week. And I don't think the few of us that work in this field, a couple hundred people that work on syndicated comic strips, the only people that really understand that sort of relentless deadline that just never goes away. Hopefully it never goes away, you know. And I describe it as sort of trying to be funny with somebody holding a gun to your head, you know. Or one of my favorite cartoonists, Fred Laswell, who did Snuffy Smith. People used to say, you know, what do you do if you have trouble coming up with an idea for the next day? And he says, I just spread some unpaid bills on my drawing board. You know? But then, you know, the process of actually producing the original art is it's pretty simple, really. I mean, once you come up with ideas, which is actually the hardest part, that's what I do on both Beetle Bailey and High and Lois. I guess you'd call me a writer, although I actually draw the ideas that I come up with. And what we do for those strips is we produce probably about three more times than what we actually use. in these little kind of pencil sketches that we call gags. Now, every cartoonist that I know, syndicated comic strip artist, works in a different way. There's no set pattern, you know. There are cartoonists like Charles Schulz who for almost 50 years did every single step of the process himself, including putting the strips in an envelope and sealing it up and taking it to the post office, you know. And that was just the way he worked. He was kind of a lone wolf type. He didn't really want to collaborate with anybody. My father, Mort Walker, is kind of the opposite. You know, he's a collaborator, a very gregarious sort of social person. And he's created what some people call King Features East or the Funny Factory, you know, where at over the years he's created 9 different comic strips and founded the museum and written books. And he's just sort of, as I call him, compulsively creative, you know. And everything in between. I mean, some cartoonists buy gags through the mail. Others do the inking, and somebody else does the penciling. Some people have letterers. Some people have other kinds of office assistants. Most cartoonists, when they're starting out, do everything themselves because they can't really afford to pay assistants. But, you know, there are other cartoonists like Patrick McDonald, who does a strip called Mutts, who pretty much does everything himself. His wife, Karen, helps him on, you know, managing his website and doing other kinds of outside stuff. But there really isn't any real rule to how it's done.
Well, then the reason I bring it up particularly is that I guess at a couple of points it's generated some controversy and I think some misunderstanding maybe the relationship particularly between Trudeau and Don Carlton and Carlton's contribution there. Some people heard that and somehow that for them that translated into Gary Trudeau actually not drawing the strip, which is really clearly not the case.
Yeah, it's kind of a curious case of you know, Carlton has worked on the strip almost from the beginning. He started in 1971, and he still does the inking on the strip. The lettering is now done on the computer, but he puts that together. He actually lives very close to the syndicate, so for many, many years, he would actually hand-deliver the stuff to the syndicate, because the other thing about Trudeau is he works so close to his deadline. I mean, you know, we're often 6-8 weeks ahead of publication. Gary can be as little as 5 days ahead of publication. And I, you know, and Don Carlton, I call him like the Carl Ripken of cartoon assistants or something, because he told me he'd never gotten sick or anything. You know, it's just unbelievable. But, yeah, there was a story that ran, I think it was in Entertainment Weekly in the early 90s, and they call Carlton Gary's ghost, you know, that Trudeau didn't really draw the strip. And I think for many, many years, you know, Gary was just very private about his, you know, his working life. I think he decided very early on that he didn't really want to do interviews. It didn't really help him, his cause. It was taking up too much of his time. So he basically had a policy of not doing interviews. So really didn't get out there too much to promote himself or what he did or how he did it or anything, you know. So it was a bit of a mystery about, you know, an aura around, you know, does he really draw the strip or anything? And, you know, of course, I had seen from, you know, when I did the exhibit at the museum, a lot of his original pencil drawings. And it sort of puzzled me. I think, you know, certainly my book is one of the only places that his pencil drawings have ever been reproduced. After all these 40 years, I mean, here they are finally on view for the public to see, which completely disproves any of these false rumors about what he does and whether Carlton is really drawing the strip.
Yeah. Well, it's very, as you say, it's very clear when you look at the pencil drawings that there's no doubt he is drawing the strip.
Right.
I do think it's sort of interesting, though, to think about because the quality of the line in the final strip is so characteristic, to me at least, that you, I have to ask, you know, how much of that does in fact come from Don Carlton?
I think that in some ways I actually prefer the pencil drawings. They're just a little softer, but I would say from other cartoonists, you know, I've seen many originals from all hundreds and hundreds of different cartoonists. I think Trudeau has about as tight a pencil line as anybody I've seen, meaning which that certainly when Carlton inks, you know, for many, many years, Gary would package his pencil drawings, which he did on the finished paper, the Strathmore paper, and sort of express mail those to Don Carlton. And then Carlton would ink right over them and then erase the pencil lines. Mm-hmm. So the finished pen and ink strip is really is the original art. That's all that's left. But beginning in the 80s, Gary's got a fax machine, and he would actually put the penciled strip through the fax machine. Carlton would get it on his end and put that on a light box, put another piece of paper on top of it, and literally like ink over it, you know, on a light box. I think that for the most part, when you see the pencils now, when you can see a separate pencil and then the finished ink, they're very close. I mean, I don't think that Carlton does a lot of freelancing, you know, adding characters in the background or doing anything differently than exactly the way that Gary drew it. Not to take anything away from what Don Carlton does, but I think it's about as close a, I don't want to say a tracing because it's a little different than just tracing, but you know, certainly the ink line has a different quality than the pencil line. Mm.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. Brian Walker is our guest. He's the author of a newly published book, Doonesbury and the Art of G.B. Trudeau. It's published by the Yale University Press. It looks at how the strip developed over time and the art of the man who created Doonesbury. It's been going now for 40 years, first appeared in October of 1970. Just to talk again about the difficulty of this deadline that he set, he, because the strip is as topical as it is, he's had to live with that kind of deadline. And as you say, a lot of other cartoonists just don't, they don't work on the deadline that tight. They're several, maybe several weeks out, that he, because of what he does, just can't do that. But right. that must really increase the pressure of coming up with your story, which, as you said, that's really the hardest part.
Yeah, I assume he kind of thrives on that pressure a little bit, you know, that, I mean, he told me that he's somewhat of a procrastinator, you know, that most cartoonists work by themselves in their studio, just by the nature of the work. So you can be in there and, you know, there's sort of legendary stories of cartoonists doing everything but what they're supposed to be doing, you know. And just procrastinating till it's the 11th hour, and then they have to do this sort of flurry of activity. You know, not all cartoonists are like that. I mean, my father's a very much of a 9-to-5 kind of guy, and he gets his work done ahead of time, if anything. And as I said, you know, we work often in the 6-8 weeks in advance. I mean, I've written, for instance, for High and Lois. You know, I've already done, like, the Sunday page for Easter next April. But it's not a topical strip. You know, it's about seasons and holidays and going to school and, you know, athletics and things like that that are just kind of cyclical. It's, you know, occasionally if it's election day, we might do a little, like, comment about, you know, the presidential candidate or something like that, but that's about it. Whereas Gary's commenting on things that are really happening he unbelievably sometimes even anticipates things that are about to happen. And I think that's one of the, most of the interviews with Gary and the articles written about Doonesbury deal with the topical nature of the strip, about all the times he's been banned for, going over the line or making somebody angry or attacking this person or that person, And I, with my book, I made a conscious effort not to get into that so much because it's been so well covered in other books and other, articles. And very little had, in the process of covering that story, a lot of writers overlooked Gary's artistic, creative side and exactly what he does in producing the strip.
Mm-hmm. Well, you want to talk, can you talk more about that, or is there anything in particular you think you would say to people? Now, the next time you look at the strip, or you go to the bookstore and you look at collection, or you go to the library and look at collection, there are particular things that your eye, because you're in the business, sees that most people don't.
Right. Well, one of the things I chronicle in the book, to start off with, Gary had has almost all of his original strips on deposit at the Beinecke Rare Book Library at Yale University. So I went up there for, about 4 days, and I went through all the strips from 1970 to about 2001, and then the rest of them I went through in his studio. So I basically looked through the entire run of the strip as original strips. And so just passing by, past my eyes, I couldn't read all those in, any reasonable amount of time, but I just visually looked at them. And I think that the strip has gone through an amazing creative evolution. It's really changed. It looks totally different now than it did when it first started. There are other strips that look very much like the way they looked on the first day of the strip. They don't change that much. Most strips do change. I think cartoonists do it kind of subconsciously. Their style evolves. The characters get a little squatter because they're always forcing them in these little boxes, But when Gary took his sabbatical in the early 80s and he came back, he had decided to break out of the sort of static look that he had developed for the strip in the 70s, which was basically, characters talking to each other, a character watching television, very much of a repetitive, static kind of imagery, which he kind of borrowed from Jules Pfeiffer. And he decided to completely redesign the strip and adopt more almost cinematic elements with close-ups and silhouettes and long shots and spotting the blacks and doing things, as he described it, like more like a story strip from the 1940s or something. And he said it was a kind of a risky turn. In looking through his strips, it didn't happen suddenly. It happened over the course of a number of years in the mid-80s. But by the end of the decade of the 80s, the strip was completely different looking. And I think that's where it really started to stand out on the comics page. A very bold, black areas and the design of it, the way it looked on the page is very distinctive, I think.
Well, he was the first, I think, to actually have the characters address the reader, look at you and to talk to you that way that, in theater and in movie, they call that breaking the fourth wall when the actor actually addresses the audience. I don't think anybody had ever done that before.
Well, you get in trouble whenever you say first. The first comic strip character who's acknowledged as the first, the yellow kid, used to have his dialogue was written on his nightshirt, so you could read it and say, like, hey, you out there, you know, look at me, you know. So that goes really back to the beginning. There were lots of examples over the years of cartoonist characters just kind of stepping out and suddenly addressing the reader directly, or like Ernie Bushmill used to do a lot of that stuff in Nancy, you know, like, you know, hey, the boss has taken the day off, you know, and they'd be drawn like in squiggles or something. You know, it actually, there's a comic scholar who has the same last name as you, Thomas Inge, who calls it metacomics, which is self-referential, where the, you know, the art is addressing the art form, you know, like you say, beyond the fourth wall. Gary didn't do that in the beginning. He started experimenting with that in the late 80s and did quite a bit of it in the early 90s and doesn't do it so much anymore. He said, you know, looking back at some of his stuff, he said, God, I really did a lot of that playing with the art form and changing styles and, you know, riffing on other people's styles and copying the layout of the USA Today, or having there's an annual thing he does where Mike and Zonka read mail, they read letters from the readers and stuff, and then respond to it. He still does that, but he doesn't do that as much as he did in the early 90s. I think that's one thing that's really interesting in this book is you go through it and you really see a sense of the journey that he's been on creatively over the last 40 years.
Yeah. And it seems that he doesn't, if he feels that he's gotten into a rut or done something too much, then he seems often also inclined to then change that and not want to do any one sort of thing too long.
He doesn't seem to be at all afraid to take creative risk. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think one of the most significant episodes in the strip is the one where BD loses his leg in Iraq. And here's his original character going back even into the Bull Tales strips.
Yeah.
And somebody that readers and millions of people are familiar with this character and know him and everything. I remember reading that sequence and just like it took my breath away when I came to that panel where he's lying on his stretcher with his, you know, missing half of his leg. And, you know, Trudeau told me that he said, you know, he did that because, you know, that's what was happening to servicemen over there, and BD was over there, and he just decided to do it. He had no idea where he was going with it. In fact, it was the first time that BD had ever been shown without a helmet on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the early days, he had a football helmet on, and then we went to Vietnam, he had an army helmet on. So he'd always had something on his head. He didn't even know what kind of hair he had, you know. He had to kind of make it up as he went along. He really didn't know where he was going with it.
Well, that's here. I guess I better be careful about making pronouncements about, you know, about firsts and so forth, but I think the thing about him is that Trudeau is that he's always been interested in making statements about politics and society and pushing things a little bit. But I think even for him and within the cartooning world, that's pretty out there. You know, to take one of your characters and to do that and to show that. I'm sure that a lot of people were really, really stunned by that, just that particular image.
Well, I think that every cartoonist adds something new to the language of comics. So, you know, it's an evolving form, really, and that's what really fascinates me. And for instance, a lot of people would say, "Well, Trudeau was the first one to introduce politics into comics." Well, once again, I can go back to the Yellow Kid again.
Mm-hmm.
Campaigning for McKinley in 1897, you know. But he did it in a different way that really pushed it further. I mean, people like Walt Kelly had a character called Simple J. Malarkey, who was a very thinly disguised caricature of Eugene McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings in the 50s. And that was a pretty brave thing for him to do at that time, you know, to really attack these, you know, politicians at that time. But it was sort of thinly disguised or veiled behind an anthropomorphic character or something like that. Because when Gary started doing his attacks on the Nixon White House and Watergate and Ehrlichman and Mitchell and people like that, I mean, he named names. I mean, he specifically put the real names into the strip, and that was a departure, I think. And I think, you know, startled some people and annoyed other people, angered other people. But I thought it was healthy for the business at the time. It kind of shook things up, and you know, by breaking the rules, he changed the rules.
And I only have about a minute here, but he's certainly has been willing to caricature living people over time. The president, though, never, other than these little symbolic representations that he has chosen for particular presidents, has never appeared. And in some cases, all you get is the words.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, he did a column in New York Times, and I published a couple of them in the book where there are caricatures of Nixon and the Bush family, which are actually spot on, excellent caricatures, like you would see a political cartoonist doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like he can't draw a caricature, you know. But I think he felt it was more effective to use these symbols, like, you know, Clinton was a waffle, you know. And it allows the reader's imagination to kind of create, you know, to kind of fill in the blanks and make a connection there, in a cerebral way about the character. You know, if he draws Clinton, everybody says, oh, well, that's just caricaturing Clinton. But he draws him as a waffle, but it's talking like Clinton, you know. It creates the kind of illusion that you're filling in that image yourself.
Well, we're going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. I'm sorry, we have a caller we can't take. We're just out of time. For folks who are listening, though, I think that you would enjoy, I certainly enjoyed looking at this book, Doonesbury and the Art of G.B. Trudeau. It is published by the Yale University Press. It's just recently come out, in part to mark the 40th anniversary of the strip, which first appeared in October of 1970. Our guest, Brian Walker, he organized the first major exhibition of Gary Trudeau's work. That was in 1983. He's known the artist for quite a long time and is part of a cartoon family himself. His dad, the creator of Beetle Bailey and High and Lois, and he and some of his siblings continue to work on the strip. Brian Walker, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. I hope we didn't get into too much cartoon shop talk here, but it's interesting, I think, for some people to hear about the sort of behind-the-scenes stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks very much.
All right. Nice talking to you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring the exhibit Sousa and His League of Players, America's Music and the Golden Age of Baseball, from the Smithsonian Institution. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Soybean futures on the Chicago Board of Trade rose to the highest spot price level in 27 and a half months today on technical buying and concerns about hot and dry conditions in Argentina. The strength in soy is helping to ease early declines in wheat that are tied to China raising its interest rates over the weekend and improving harvest weather in Southeast Australia. Let's look at the particulars in Kansas City. March wheat now at 842 and a half, down 2.5. May, 850 and a half, down 2.5. July, 855 and a half, down 2.25. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is at 7.78¾, down 4¼. May, 8.06, down 4¼. July, 8.17¾, down 5¼. March corn, 6.16 up two, now up 1¾ at 6.15¾. May, 6.23½, up 1½. July, 6.27¼, up 1½. Go out to December, 5.52½, up 1¼. January soybeans are at 13.